The Triathlon Show 284. What's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I interview coach Neil McPherson. Neil is a Scottish coach living in Cape Town, South Africa, where he, together with his wife, Diana, co-owns and runs the coaching business and performance center, Dynamic Coaching. Neil is also a coach educator and facilitator, having done a lot of coach education work for both British Triathlon and for the ITU, the International Triathlon Union. So he has plenty of experience to discuss coaching from both a coach-athlete relationship perspective, but also as somebody who has helped educate other coaches and also mentoring some other coaches. We'll get right into the interview after thanking our sponsors. First, we have Roka that you can find on roka.com. Roka are the world-leading manufacturers of wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses. Roka's wetsuit lineup is where the company got started with the mission of creating the world's fastest wetsuit, and now they have a whole range of wetsuits from the entry-level Maverick Comp 2 to the flagship-level Maverick X2 wetsuit, with a number of wetsuits in between, including also a thermal wetsuit and a swimrun wetsuit. Roka's wetsuits have technologies such as the patented Arms Up technology. They all come with premium materials and lots of other bells and whistles depending on which level of wetsuit you're going for. You can check them out on roka.com, but regardless of your ability and your wetsuit budget, you can find something that is suitable for you and is going to be an amazing wetsuit for years to come. You can get 20% off your order with the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS. And thank you to Senate. The Senate Swim Trainer is an inflatable swim bench that you're using together with a set of standard stretch cords. But as opposed to standard stretch cords, which you would use standing up and therefore putting a lot of strain through your hamstrings and your posterior chain, and also not at all being specific to the swimming position, with the Zen 8 Swim Trainer, you're laying down on the swim bench in the same specific position to what you will have in the water when you're actually swimming. So therefore, you can train the movement correctly and ingrain the right movement patterns and not just work your arms somehow, which is what normal stretch cord use is more like. In addition, you can work on some specific aspects of your swim stroke, such as the high elbow catch, which the height of the swim bench is perfectly designed to help you work on, and your core activation because of the instability element of the swim bench. The Senate Swim Trainer is not designed to be a replacement for pool swimming, but it can be a great adjunct to it. So you can add a couple of short sessions per week to what you're already doing in the pool. And it also opens up opportunities to do some specific training like swim bike brick workouts, where you can do a high-intensity Senate Swim Trainer set just before jumping on your bike, whether it's on the indoor trainer or going out on the roads, and doing that right after finishing that simulated dryland swim session. You can get 20% off your order of the Zen 8 Swim Trainer with the promo code that you can get on zen8swimtrainer.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Coach Neil McPherson. Today's guest on the Triathlon Show is Neil McPherson. Neil, how are you doing today?
Not too bad at all, thank you. Not too bad at all. Hope you're well as well.
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Can you start by telling the audience and myself a bit more about your background and where you're calling in from, so to say?
I'm calling in from the beautiful city of Cape Town in South Africa, where I am involved as a coach with Dynamic Coaching. It's a coaching concern that was started actually by my wife when she retired from competing as a triathlete. My involvement was almost accidental. You could say I'm an accidental coach. I was involved in triathlon and duathlon in the mid-1990s to keep fit. I participated and raced at national level as an age grouper, not with much success, but I enjoyed it. My wife, on the other hand, was quite good, and she actually went on to race professionally. My journey into coaching started when we went to the UK in about 2003 and she was unable to get onto any of the performance squads there because she's South African. So after looking around, there wasn't as many coaches available then as there are now. And so after looking around a little bit, we decided to just do it ourselves, which started me on the ongoing journey of learning how to be a coach. I coached her for a few years until 2006, where she achieved her goal of racing professionally at Kona. And after having achieved that goal, she then decided to retire and thought, okay, what am I going to do? So she was asked to get involved in coaching with a couple of the local clubs. And as part of that, she went on and did the British Triathlon level coaching courses. And basically to keep her company, I went along and did them as well. Found out I enjoyed them, found out I really enjoyed the process of coaching, and was then later on asked if by British Triathlon to get involved with their coach education program, became a facilitator for them. And by 2010, I was basically working with three different clubs, working with Edinburgh University as the head coach at Edinburgh University, and realizing that this could be my full-time job. So 2011, we moved back to Cape Town from Scotland, where we decided to open the doors of the Dynamic Training Center, which offers analysis and testing and training to age group athletes and professionals for that matter. And that's where we've gone from there. I was then asked to be involved with the National Federation. I helped set up their coach education program. That got me involved with the International Triathlon Union, and I've been doing facilitation for them on coach education in some weird and wonderful places like Nepal, Iran, Gambia, Niger. Not many people know that there's a national federation in Gambia. So coaching as a day-to-day job, coach education on the side, you could say. And it's been an interesting 15 years, and that's what I do now. Full-time coach educator, operating out of Cape Town, working with athletes all over the world.
Yeah, and just to mention that center that you mentioned again with that you have with Dynamic Coaching in Cape Town, you do testing, performance testing, and some other analysis there as well as your services.
We have an endless pool which we use for swim video analysis. We also do lactate testing. We do bike fit utilizing the retail system. It's just basically to try and give people a one-stop shop, video analysis on the run, to try and find that competitive edge that maybe they can't get just from training and training and training.
Yeah. And a couple of questions there, follow-ups on your introduction. What got you into coaching? You said that you kind of found out that you enjoyed it. What was it that got you sucked in?
Necessity. As I mentioned, my wife we were needing somebody to help us with her development as an athlete. That happened to be me. I was the one on hand to do it. Went and did a lot of reading, went up to Stirling University and spoke to some of the coaches up there who were in the performance program, got feedback from them, and then just tried to be a sponge and take as much on board as I could and applied it to the training and the conditioning that my wife was going to need to race. And that was it. Initially, that's all it was. And from that, when we started Dynamic Coaching, when my wife started Dynamic Coaching, I basically came along just to assist. The idea was it was a part-time thing for me just to help out. And I really enjoyed the interaction. I enjoyed the mental challenge. I enjoyed, finding solutions to problems.
Yeah.
Nobody is the same. And people will come to you and thinking, how can I get faster? Even strategy on a race. Interestingly enough, I was talking to one of our associate coaches this morning, and they have a young athlete who's going up to race in the Intercontinental Champs in a few weeks' time. And we were discussing, okay, what do we have to do? Who is she going to be racing? Okay, what is the strategy we need? We know what her strengths are. We know what her weaknesses are. We know at the moment that there's been a bit of an issue around plantar fasciitis. So we can't do too much on the run. What are we going to do to give ourselves a competitive advantage? It's it's brilliant. It's like an unassembled jigsaw. And you've got to look at the pieces and you've got to put, and you don't even have the picture. You don't even have the full picture, but you've got to put those pieces together to build a picture. And it's only when the pictures, when you've done that, do you actually really see the whole package.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And if we start talking about your, how you view coaching and training, if you want to call it, I always call it kind of coaching or training philosophy, even though I don't necessarily think that that's a good term, but I can't think of an alternative. So can you describe that, how you view those things?
If I was to sum it up in one word, it would be individualized. Coaching, the bane of my life is 12-week programs to an Ironman. Cut and paste. Here's a program that works. My philosophy is that you have to sit down with an athlete. You have to identify where they currently are. You've got to make sure that they understand what their goals are. You've got to understand, are those goals realistic in the time frame that they're talking about? And then you've got to work out what you have to do with that athlete to move them from that point to their destination. You can call it periodization. I call it road mapping. And so my philosophy on coaching is everybody's going to be on a journey, and that journey is going to require different tools. It's going to maybe go in different directions. So you cannot just have a one-size-fits-all, one approach, one standard. You've got to be flexible. You've got to be flexible in what you prescribe. You've got to be flexible in your feedback. You've got to be flexible in the way you take on board feedback. And I think I mentioned to you earlier that one of the things that concerns me with a lot of online programs and systems is athletes and coaches, for that matter, confusing data download with feedback.
Yes, you did mention that, and I totally agree.
And yeah, I mean, so people, there you go. And for example, Garmin or Polo or whatever, they download the files and you're left with the files. And yes, there's a lot of interesting information there. But unless you, it's like emails, there's so much lost. So you need to have that interaction, communication. You need to have that communication with the athlete. And that can be through various methodologies, but it simply isn't about programs and training. It's simply not just about, here is a standard, standalone, one-size-fits-all approach. It's got to be flexible.
Yeah, no, that's a really great overview. And if we go into that feedback side a little bit more, because I think this is something that maybe a lot of athletes are not really aware of. Like when you start working with a coach, of course, the coach will tell you what kind of feedback they expect. But many athletes have never had a coach and maybe doesn't really know what they should be. And this is even for writing your own, if you're a self-coached athlete, writing your own comments on in your training log. So, but if you're working with an athlete, how do you educate them in what sort of feedback you're looking for? Like what are the things that you want them to give you?
Look, I use Final Search as the diary. And I will go through each session and I will look at how well they performed. And I put information into the comments box. Asking questions. Okay. I see you went over on that. You went over the power numbers there. Why? I'll sometimes in the program deliberately put things in there in the prescribed session. They doing a session, ask me why we're doing this. So in fact, in the sessions, I actually try and stimulate them to come and contact me. If I haven't had any feedback from the athlete, I will go and speak to them and say, I'll pick up the phone. Okay. I need more information. It's not just enough to have the download. Put this, how did you feel? Use, and I don't like tick boxes either because it's too easy just to tick the middle box and tick on the box. I want written feedback on how did you might have hit the numbers, but were you working 9 out of 10 to hit those numbers, or were you working 6 out of 10 to hit those numbers? So it's just using the phone, using email, using the comments in Final Search. And if you don't get feedback, ask again. And ask again and keep asking. And if it's consistently, and to be honest with you, I mean, if you consistently don't get the feedback, then you've got to seriously sit down and say, is this coach-athlete relationship working? And maybe it's not the appropriate coach-athlete relationship, and maybe there's got to be, they might do better with somebody else. They might do better with one of our other coaches. And we've done that. We've actually had situations where we felt that there just wasn't that connection. And so another coach has stepped in, and there's a better empathy. And that's worked. And sometimes we've had to say, look, you know, this just isn't working. We don't feel that we can give you the service. We don't feel we can give you the level of training that you want with the communication that we're having. And sometimes you have to walk away.
Yeah. Do you have any views on when do you need the feedback? Because this is something that, like, just from a pure, from my own coaching perspective, I've been in situations where sometimes I have to wait 3 days for getting a comment on the session, and like, it gets annoying.
Yeah.
What's your view on that?
I think it depends on, the session. Like, if it's a test, I want the information right away. As soon as you finish it, as soon as you finish the test, I want the information right away. Partly because I've then got to adjust the program going forward based on the test results. If it's just, if it's been a steady pace run in the middle of the week, I don't need the feedback straight away on that. So it depends on the session. As we get closer to goal races, you're going to be wanting it on a more regular basis. And so you might be having conversations twice, three times a week. If we're at the beginning of a program and we're just building the volume, and there's very little intensity, and there's very little focus on technique, drop me a line at the week. Let me know how it went. If there's anything I need to know, let me know. So it's not a fixed point. Varies depending on where we are in the season. Obviously, if something's gone wrong, you need to know straight away. If the person said, I just couldn't get those numbers today, gave it everything and I couldn't get those numbers, I need to know straight away. And we then need to sit down and have a conversation. Okay, let's look at your nutrition. Let's look at have you changed your nutrition the last couple of days? Have you been sleeping? What are the other factors that might have changed? Sometimes just had a bad day. Sometimes we need to relook at what we're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I generally agree with that. I think that the issue that I still might potentially have with giving the feedback like several days later, if we're talking about that, even if everything went sort of all right, is that you run the risk of, like, as an athlete, you don't really remember the finer details or nuances of how that session felt as you did in the moment. Some fine details get lost. And then for that particular session, it doesn't matter. But if that happens consistently, then you're not getting as clear of a picture. It's more of you're seeing the picture in black and white rather than in full color.
It's interesting being a little bit of a Luddite. I was actually going through my old training logs, and these were actual diaries that you kept, and you would fill it in every day with the session you did, and the level of detail that you used to put into that was huge. And we don't tend to do that with utilizing online systems anymore. We're talking about a run, and as you said, how you were feeling, what the weather was like, the fact that it was slippery, the tarmac was slippery because it was dew. You look at the level of detail that went into that. Maybe it's something we're working on too much convenience, and there's too much, press a button for was it a good session, how did you feel, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe we need to actually pay a little bit more attention to that.
Yeah. A couple of other interesting things that we talked about in our email conversation before this interview that I want to chat a little bit about is, first of all, you mentioned an example of training an athlete or coaching an athlete right now to their first Ironman. Mm-hmm. But this particular athlete has a background as participating in the Olympic Games, but in a different sport than triathlon, in an explosive sport. So completely the opposite side of the spectrum. And I'm curious to hear more about that.
This is a guy who was a full-time professional athlete in an Olympic sport, well-funded Olympic sport. And so he'd been training for years as a full-time professional. He had recently stepped away from that, and for some bizarre reason, he decided to try something completely different and wanted to do an Ironman. He reached out to me for some assistance. And what was nice is, as a professional, ex-professional athlete, his discipline, his understanding of coaching process was there. Interact. He knew what was required. If you told him to do something, he would do it. But when we started off and did some testing, his top end power was through the roof. But what that also meant was that at every level of power, he was utilizing his glycolytic system. And that meant that as the further and further we went, that the drop-off got bigger and bigger and bigger. So what we had to actually do was detune him. He was everything he was doing was full bore. And as somebody who'd done an explosive sport, which also a very competitive one-on-one type sport, everything he did, he wanted to do to the max. And it was actually an education process, trying to teach him that there is benefit in going easy. He felt, you know, if he's not going hard, you know, can it be of any real benefit? And one of the things that we had to, that was very useful, especially on the run, was I very quickly moved him on to running with a power meter. Because his perception of effort was bizarre. He thought he was going easy when he was probably running in about 8.5, 9 out of 10, realistically. Running over threshold, running close to VO2, but he didn't think it was that hard because he'd been so used to doing these maximal top-end efforts.
And he has a massive anaerobic battery, so it doesn't feel like it's not getting drained like quickly.
Exactly. And it was actually quite interesting. Even when we looked at some of the initial tests, like a 3-minute test and a 10-minute test, there wasn't that much of a drop-off because he had this massive battery. There was then a drop-off. If we looked at doing a 5-kilometer test, there was quite a bit of a drop-off then. But then the drop-off, as it went longer, became monumental. So I said, literally, we had to detune him. We had to teach him to become an aerobic creature, and that took a bit of that takes some humbling, because they're taking something that somebody's good at and prides themselves upon, and actually saying to them, you know, that this is actually not only not useful to you, it's actually hindering you. So it was educating him on the benefit of going easy, understanding that there is that is what is required. And understanding that not everything has to be done flat out. The Ironman was postponed, so we're now looking at September. The process is growing, and he's actually doing really well. I'm expecting a sub-9-hour Ironman from him on his first attempt. But the other thing was he has the tendency to try and power his way through things, and that impacted on the swim. Physically incredibly robust individual, and his tendency on the swim was just to try and smash his way through the water, as opposed to looking for efficiency in the water. And that was, utilizing power was very effective. Look at all the power you're using, but it's not being used effectively.
And here we should maybe mention that you're also using the TrainSense smart paddle, so you can actually look at the direction of force and power application in the swim stroke and see, okay, maybe the power is really, really high, but most of it goes downwards, like vertically or laterally.
Some of those numbers, not just with this athlete, when people come in and they see it, it's eye-opening, especially at the front end of the stroke, the amount of power that is being used in a downward direction, 60, 70% of power in occasion. And what's really nice about that as well is you can also then say, okay, try changing this, try doing that. And you can then actually quantitatively see the difference. So it's not so much about, changing subject slightly, but that's what you were doing. If you do that, that's what you get. Very, very useful tool.
Yeah. And one reason that I wanted to talk about this example, other than it being just really interesting as an example in itself, but with amateurs coming into triathlon, of course, we have a lot of amateurs coming from running or cycling and so on, but there are also people coming from different backgrounds, from team sports or from CrossFit or what have you. So we might have many amateurs that are in a kind of similar situation, maybe not like at such an extreme end as this Olympic athlete, but still, that require an approach that might be quite similar in terms of training and adaptation to triathlon. So what learnings do you think they should take from this example?
One, take a long-term view. Okay. Don't expect to change something in the short term. Take a long-term view. Understand that it's going to require change and adaption. Appreciate that it's going to require you to do things differently and to it's going to be uncomfortable. And it's going to be uncomfortable because you're coming from an area of excellence. And often that excellence, in fact, is going to be counterproductive. It could be counterproductive for what you're now wanting to do. So be patient with yourself. And I think that's one of the important things, is you've got to be patient with yourself and you've got to be kind to yourself. It took you years to build up a level of expertise in this other sport, whether it be rowing, whether it be football. It's going to take you time to adapt to this new sport. And what you can take from that sport is the discipline. You can take the focus and the mental fortitude. But if you're coming from explosive sports like CrossFit, it's a completely different ballgame. There's not an awful lot of the anaerobic benefits that you could use in an Ironman. Sprint distance triathlon, slightly different. But for an Ironman, I'm a huge fan of CrossFit. I think, if somebody is looking to get fit and they have a limited time and they just want to be functionally fit, I think CrossFit's a great thing. I don't particularly like it as a strength and conditioning for triathletes. I think there's too much focus on high intensity interval training. And I think it actually compromises the aerobic system and puts too much focus on the anaerobic system. It's that seesaw effect. Yep. If you're overdeveloping the one, you're compromising the other. You're going to have to be patient and you're going to have to spend a lot of time, depending on what sport you're coming from, on a lot of time doing the boring stuff. And it's not sexy.
Yep.
It's repetitive and it's often tedious, but we're in an endurance sport where, if you're lucky, you're finishing in 9 hours. You can't expect to do that quickly.
No. Just to illustrate a little bit, maybe keep talking about this former Olympian, once you're an Olympian, you're always an Olympian. When you're doing his, maybe you want to call it harder session or like quality sessions, like not just the regular endurance workouts, what type of workouts would those be? Would they be more like Ironman race pace or maybe like tempo and threshold work, or would you still have him sometimes do more like interval training above threshold?
Yeah. Initially, I stayed away from the above threshold training because I wanted to reduce that anaerobic capacity a little bit. Where we are currently is we're now reintroducing intervals. On the bike, we can be doing anything from 3 minute to 8 minute intervals, depending, and the power will depend on that time frame. If it's 3 minutes, we might be working at about 120% off FTP. If it's 8 minutes, we're going to be working probably more about the 107-108%. And I don't just utilize threshold power, critical power. I think that's an interesting number. But you can have two people with the exact same FTP and they're not going to ride the same time. Same weight, same body, same bike. Just because their FTP is the same doesn't mean the same, they're going to be able to ride for an hour at the same pace. At this stage, not doing much at all on very short intervals, 30 seconds, 1 minute, not needing that at all, certainly for this athlete. And threshold work, we will normally do threshold work and tempo work. The tempo work I tend to put into the long bike as part of the long bike. Threshold work we do as a standalone in the week. And that would be anything from 15 minutes up to 60 minutes. And again, we will play with the power numbers depending on that. If we're doing 15 minutes, we'll be at a higher power, at a higher percentage. If it's a 60 minute, it's going to be at a lower percentage. And incorporated into that, we'll also play with different cadence. One, just to develop the ability to ride at different cadences. And two, also just, recruiting different muscle fibers and developing different muscle fibers with, say, for high torque work and low cadence.
Yeah, and is the approach kind of corresponding on the run and the swim as to what you described?
Yeah, within reason. On the swim, I do tend to have a higher percentage. I use a higher percentage. I work up to a higher percentage on the swim, simply because I think the body can handle it. There's not the same stress. On the run, I don't use as much as on the bike. A lot of age groupers, they need to recover. Once we've got the volume there, there's no stage do I ever just have base work. We are always incorporating elements of threshold work, tempo work, VO2 work, even in when we're building the volume. But once we've got a big enough volume to really go and weigh and look at the power side of things, then we will integrate interval work and we will integrate some speed work, accelerations. I think you can use accelerations and surges really well to get the top end speed work without having to go to the track and do 200s and 100s. Hills are great for that as well. And are probably more specific to sort of running a triathlete, and certainly an Ironman triathlete would need.
Yeah, no, that's hill work is great for like just a neuromuscular development of recruiting like a large amount of your muscle fibers, including those fast twitch fibers, to work
and
on speed.
You can throw those into a long run. I mean, go and do a long run, nice and easy pace. Do some surges, you know, get everything loosened up, and then hit some, depending on where we are in the season again, and then hit some hills. 5 repeats, 6 repeats, might even get up to 10 repeats with lots of recovery. 20 seconds, 30 seconds, you know, going on 2 minutes. And that's all about what you were saying, the muscle recruitment and getting that posterior kinetic chain firing, making sure that everything's working the way it should be working. And then off you go and finish off with another, 8, 9, 10 Ks of easy running.
Yep. And then another topic that I want to discuss is a very kind of typical profile for an athlete that you see a lot and that I see a lot as well is the kind of experienced athlete who has ambitious goals like qualifying for or performing at world championship level events, but might be at a bit of a plateau and haven't really improved that much in some time and don't really know what to do next. So what do you feel are some common reasons for athletes hitting such a plateau? And then when they come to you and you help them out, what are the methods that you use to then help them get to that next level and reach their goals?
I certainly see with a lot of age group athletes, they get focused on their goal race. And they go and do it, and then they step away in the off season. They step away for 2 months, 3 months, and then once the 3 months is over, they say, "Okay, I'm going to do another race." And all the benefits that they built up leading into that race have gone. So you'll often find athletes are repeating the same thing year in, year out, and they're never getting the advantage of building on what they'd built before. So they're building themselves up. They're then letting those strengths dissipate over a 3 month period, and then they're starting again. A lot of the athletes that we've worked with for over years, they stay with us year in, month out, year in, year out. Yes, you need take time off. You need recovery, but you can't take 3 months off and stop. I think that's one of the biggest things. The other issues that I see is short term, they don't take a long term view. They're not planning 3 years ahead. They're not planning 4 years ahead, and that's where you really get the benefits. I'm not saying that you shouldn't have short term goals, but you should be looking that far ahead. Even if you're an age grouper, if you want to, that could be going to Kona and getting in the top 10 in your age group at Kona. In order to do that, you probably need to go there first and really suss it out. So you need to get there twice. In order to do that, you need to, have a good Ironman. You need to know who you're competing against. You need to know the times you need. So you're looking at doing that twice. You might not do it the first time. Learn from the first time. The second time you qualify. Third time you go to Kona. Then you go again. A long-term plan rather than a short-term, what am I going to do? What bucket list race am I going to do this year? Another factor is, again, it's, I see a lot of athletes working in groups and they're going out with their groups and with their friends. And as a consequence, the training is very average. And I'm not meaning that as a quality average. I'm meaning it that everybody's doing everything at the same level. And it may not be appropriate for that person. It may not be appropriate in terms of intensity. It may not be appropriate in terms of volume. It may not even be appropriate in terms of what they're doing at that time you can have people who are racing at different times of the year training together at the same time. How can that be appropriate for two people? Somebody's racing in June, somebody's racing in September, and yet they're going out and doing the same session. That cannot be specific to the athlete. So lack of specificity in their training. You have to be selfish. You have to actually say, this is my training for my goals. This is what I'm doing. If you want to come along with me, that's fine. But it may not be appropriate for you. The training that I'm doing is appropriate for me. And as I think the social aspect of going out and riding with your mates and doing sessions on Zwift, is that session specific to what you are needing to do? Probably not.
Yeah. Well, Zwift is great because they have this functionality. I've never used it personally, actually. But I've been riding with a mate on Zwift, and what he tends to do sometimes when I've been in a slightly fitter shape is that he's been weight doping. So, and then you can ride together. And that's fine when you're not racing or anything. So, yeah. But then the other thing is that you actually have with Zwift the official group workouts, or you can just set up your group workouts and have then sort of be at a specific percentage, and everybody stays together in the group. So that's a useful tool that can actually be used in a social environment. The other thing I would say about that is that just to plug a past episode I did a few weeks ago, TTS First Day number 6 was on group training, how to use it and how not to use it. So listeners that want to hear more details about that can go and listen to it. But I agree with you. I think that, and that's one of the things you mentioned earlier about discipline and like this Olympian that you're coaching, for example, understanding what it takes, and sometimes, like, if your goal is to go to Kona or perform at Kona, you have to realize that, well, maybe you have the trade-off between doing optimal training for you or training with your mates, and you need to kind of maybe sometimes be aware that the discipline of doing the best training for you at the level that you should be doing it is what's going to make a difference in the long run if you do that consistently. And not to say that you should never train in a group, of course.
No.
But yeah, it's something that it can't always be like exactly what you think is like the most fun on the day, because that's not the way to improve.
And I think that's important. And I'm really glad you said that, because it also touches on the fact that it requires sacrifice. There might be other races that you really want to do, and you really want to be in great shape for those races, but it's mid-season and you can't take your eye off the ball. That is not the goal race. That is not the A race. That you can go and do it. We can use it to test things out, to try things out, try out nutrition, try out different positions. But we can't expect to perform optimally at every race when we are focusing on a goal race. And that requires the athlete to be very intrinsically motivated. You cannot rely on the external motivation of going to races and getting the kudos of, oh, well done, you did brilliantly at that race. Because you're going to maybe go to races and you're trying things out, we're experimenting, and you don't have a great race. And so you don't get that external applause. You don't get that that pat on the back. So you've got to be able to internally motivate yourself to go out and do it. The coach can help you. But at the end of the day, you've got to have the intrinsic motivation to go out and do the hard work, often on your own, often in the dark and in the cold. And sometimes that means doing it without your mates.
Yeah. The other thing you mentioned there before about taking 3 months off or something like that, and that being resetting you to square one, it's something that, like, I've been harping on about quite often, is that we often look at our training from a very micro perspective when we should be zooming out and looking at it from a macro perspective. And we tend to look at, well, how much training did I do this week, for example, as a key metric. But then you tend to forget your bad weeks and you look at, okay, I did a few 15-hour weeks. But if you did a couple of them, you think that, well, my training volume is 15 hours per week or so. But actually, when you look at it from a yearly perspective and your average is 8 hours per week, then that's maybe the reason that you're not quite at the level yet to qualify for Kona, and you need to zoom out and look at, well, how much training in a given year do I actually need to do to get that fitness to really be able to compete for those spots.
And I think that's why it's critical when you have that discussion with the athlete that we talk about goals and whether those goals are actually realistic and effective. And it's great to have a goal and say, yeah, I want to go to Kona. I want to win my age group in Kona. Great. Okay. Ain't going to happen this year. It's not going to happen. You've got to be honest with the athlete and say, it's not going to happen. It's not, I'm not saying it's not possible going forward, but in the time between now and then and where you currently are, it's not going to happen. We need to take a longer term view. And that's, I mean, that's one of the key components of coaching is honesty. You can sometimes maybe sugarcoat it a bit nicer, but at the end of the day, you've got to be honest with the athlete, and the athlete has got to take, we come back to it again, that long-term view. Very few people, and I think you're so right, people, they tend to, there's two things. The older we get, the faster we used to be in our minds. And I think the same thing applies for the training. As you identified, we remember our good weeks. We don't remember our bad weeks. And so we have to look at the big picture, both going back and going forward. We can't just take snapshots.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you want to mention about advice for listeners when it comes to if they have goals such as qualifying for Kona or performing at a world championship level?
A lot of people will probably disagree with me on this one, but I think there's a lot to be said for working on your technique. I know there's a number of coaches who say you're wasting your time doing drills. I don't agree with that. I think you can a lot of people, especially age groupers, never had the foundation in swimming, certainly, and often they don't have they have very poor running form. And drills can, and working on technique can make a huge difference. A case in point, during the lockdown, we had the COVID lockdown here in South Africa last year, and so you weren't allowed to swim, pools were closed. We were very fortunate we were allowed to stay open because one person at a time. And because we were one of the few places that you could swim, I had one guy come to me and say, look, I just want to come once a week and swim with you once a week. That's fine. So he came along and I convinced him when he was here to actually work on technique. And when the lockdown period ended, he went out and did the same swim course that he'd done just prior to the lockdown period. So it was a 2.5K route. It was a 2.5K route. And he'd been swimming once a week for 10 weeks. So he couldn't have been any fitter because he'd previously been swimming three times a week. So the only thing that had changed was technique. And he improved his swim time by 20 seconds per 100.
Wow. and what was the starting level for
that? He was swimming 150 per 100, yeah, and he went down to 130.
Wow.
What? Now, that's a big difference.
Yeah.
That's
You know, and it's not normal, I think it's fair to say.
Look, I quite often with athletes, I often see athletes getting anywhere between 15, 20 seconds by working on technique in the pool. Not talking getting from 130 to 110. But when the guys are coming in at the two minute per 100 mark, they're coming in at the 150 mark. If they, and they've often never, and I know you wanted to talk about swimming later, they've often never actually been shown how to swim correctly. And by actually integrating some fairly basic stuff, they can get huge improvements. Same thing with equipment. People have great equipment. They don't utilize it properly. Bike fit, often they're in positions that aren't sustainable or are just inefficient. So you can spend money on the bike. Spend some more money and make sure that it's set up correctly for you. You can get some real gains there. And I think understanding your pacing on the run, investment in equipment, again, running parameters, I'm a huge fan of. I think it's a game changer for running. It allows so much more control for the athlete and for the coach.
Yeah. Let's move on to swimming, as you mentioned, because I do want to discuss that. First, if we just continue on that theme of technique improvement, what are some common things you see in these athletes that may be coming in at 2 minutes per 100 or 150 per 100 that they need to improve? Of course, it will depend, but some common examples.
Yeah, I think probably the biggest one of the big, most common things I see and I hear is people come in and they say, oh, my legs are low in the water, sinky leg syndrome. And what I find interesting about that is it's a classic example of people confusing cause with symptom. Because their legs are low in the water, they think that the legs are the problem. And in fact, legs in the being low in the water could be as a consequence of head position. It could be a consequence of breathing. It could be a consequence of the downward propulsion at the front end of the stroke. It could be a consequence of poor core. And it could be a consequence of, you know, bad kicking as well. But or it could be all of those. So that we have to identify what is the cause and what is the problem. And what is the symptom? And low legs are a classic one that you see in most of these age groupers. And it's not low legs per se, it's poor body position and the ability to maintain body position. And very often that is as a result of the inability or the lack of understanding of what a catch is. They've all heard the term catch, but they actually don't know what a catch is. It's the misunderstanding of the term high elbow. They come in and they've all done zipper drills and they've done fingertip drag drills, and they keep a high elbow. Well, in fact, that's irrelevant. What's happening above the water in the recovery really is an irrelevance when it compared to what's happening with the elbow under the water. I use video analysis a lot. One, to be able to show them. If you can show somebody what they're doing, their perception of what they're doing, what they're actually doing, is often very different. In their own mind, they think they're doing this long, elongated, smooth stroke. When you show them the actual video, the one person described it beautifully as looking like an epileptic tadpole. So they can see what they're doing wrong. You can then show them with the video, look at what you're doing. You can then, using things like the smart paddles, show them the metrics. And for example, if you're pushing your hand down that way, if you're pushing force down, then what direction is your body going? I use the term physics 101. If you want to go forward, the water's got to be going backwards. And if you can then show them visually using video and using numbers, you are not pushing water forward. You're not pushing water backwards. You are pushing water down. You're pushing water sideways. So one of the things we work on is helping them develop a catch. But again, in order to develop a catch, you've got to have your arm in the right position. So you need to have the correct entry. And again, another misconception of swimming is, and I see a lot of it, is thumb entry. People coming in with a thumb entry and then doing an S shape. The only thing the thumb entry ever does is blow you a tater cuff. So we focus on leading with the fingers. We focus on getting the hand in at an angle suitable for that particular athlete that will allow them to generate a catch. Again, often you'll see people trying to keep their arm far too high on the surface of the water. And with their limited range of shoulder-to-shoulder flexibility, they're never going to get a catch at that point. So instead, the arm goes straight down, generating downward propulsion, and they just are unable to generate a catch. So things that we work on, making sure that their arm is able to come in, which means we're working on rotation. Once the arm is in, that they are able to then, they know what a catch is and they're able to generate a catch. They're able to hold that catch and that it will generate the propulsion. I like them to focus on engaging core just through the simple technique of squeezing your glutes. And in fact, what I do quite often is I have them swimming. I'll show them video footage of them swimming. And then I'll say, okay, I want you to swim again. But when I put my hand in the air, I want you to squeeze your glutes really tight. And just carry on swimming. Don't change anything else. Just squeeze your glutes. And it's remarkable. You'll often see, so they're swimming along and the legs are down. And then when they see me with a hand in the air, they squeeze their glutes for all they're worth and they carry on swimming. And you just see the body coming up and the feet coming up, everything tightening up, becoming alignment, and they're swimming faster. Simply because by squeezing the glutes, they're engaging their core. And by engaging the core, everything else, just the feet come together, the kick gets faster, the turnover happens. And I think a lot of people, when they swim, they've been told, relax in the water. No, why? Why would you relax in the water? When you're on the time trial bars, when you're cycling, you're not relaxed, you're engaged. When you're running with correct form, you're not floppy and relaxed, you're engaged. Swimming's no different. You need to be engaged, which means you need to engage your core, which means you, and the simplest way of doing that is by thinking about squeezing your glutes, pointing your toes, squeezing your glutes. That can actually make, that can save seconds. I've seen people gain seconds per 100 just by squeezing their toes and pointing their glutes. And you've then got to go through the process of, you know, they were unconsciously incompetent. They've got to focus on it, push off the wall, play with it, really squeeze, then begin to loose, begin to relax, feel where the legs begin to drop. Once they are consciously aware of it, they can keep ingraining it and keep doing it until it becomes unconsciously competent. So body position is often impacted by the propulsive stuff and the core engagement. So making sure the hand is in the correct position to get a catch, and making sure that we are engaged when we swim. And you can get gains on that. You can really get gains on that.
Yeah, no, that's a really good piece of advice. And
one last one as well is cadence. I see far too many age group swimmers swimming with a ridiculously low turnover.
But it's good for your swolf to do that.
Don't start me on that. Oh, the most ridiculous thing in the world. Most people tend to run at a cadence of between 160 and 180. Most people tend to cycle at a cadence of similar cadence. Why should our swim be any different? Arms and our legs, we move them in conjunction. So why are we suddenly doing swimming at 35, 40 strokes per minute? Yes, you need to have the cardiovascular engine to do it, but we're triathletes. If we don't have the cardiovascular effort to support a higher cadence in the swim, then who does?
Yeah, no, totally. I think that the Swim Smooth team have a really good chart, actually, because I do think cadence or stroke rate depends also on how fast you are, because if you're swimming 2 minutes per 100 and you're trying to swim at a cadence of 70 or 80 strokes per minute, then you're probably just slipping through the water and not really doing anything with it. So then it makes sense that your cadence should be lower until you get to a point where you're getting some benefit from that stroke rate. But that chart basically plots kind of a range where your cadence should be depending on how fast you are. And the faster you are, the higher stroke rate should be. So that is a really good resource that if listeners Google it, they can find
Swim, it. Swim Smooth, the Swim Smooth was first adopted by British Triathlon back in about 2004, 2005, I think it was. And British Triathlon adopted the Swim Smooth model. So obviously when I did my coaching qualifications with British Triathlon, I was exposed to that. And in fact, ITU, International Triathlon Union, actually are using the Swim Smooth model as well. So I've got a lot of time and respect for the Swim Smooth approach. And a lot of what I do is based around them. But like all things, as you were saying about the chart, the favorite phrase of most coaches are, it depends. And that chart is, if you're swimming at that pace, that cadence. But I would also ask, if you increase the cadence, your swim's going to get faster as well.
Yeah, well, I think the good thing is that it has a range. So it's not, well, you should have this exact stroke rate. It's a bit pretty broad range to be fair. But that's really good with stroke rate and for the open water especially, like it becomes all the more important. We're not pool swimmers, we're triathletes. Good stuff.
Which again is, I mean, I don't know why people are still coached with like zipper drill and fingertip drag when most of them are going to be wearing a wetsuit. You're never going to be able to do that in a wetsuit. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. Well, let's discuss a little bit of how you're using the smart paddle. I think maybe you can first explain what it is, because I don't think all listeners are aware of it.
Sure. The smart paddle is a small, smaller than your palm, that goes onto each hand. And it has got gyroscopes and accelerometers built into it. The information from that is then Bluetoothed to an app, which you have on your phone poolside, which allows you to then look at the information that is sent from the devices. And what the device is doing is it's measuring the amount of force that is produced. They don't like to use the word power, so they're using force, and it measures the force and it measures the direction of force that is produced with each hand on each stroke. And you can actually go in and look at every stroke by stroke, or you can look at an average of strokes over, you know, 100 meters, 200 meters, whatever. And it then you get both the numbers and you also can visually see graphically on a graph the percentage of force that is exerted, both driving you forwards, pushing your body up by going downwards, and lateral. And it actually can plot as well the actual movement from above and from the side off your hand when you swim. So that's what it does. And literally, we have it, a person could be swimming within a minute of them finishing, say, a 400 meter. I can have them looking at a screen above the pool, and we can go through and actually the stroke by stroke and say, let's have a look, and then let's look at the video as well. Look at what you're doing here on the video. And let's look at what your hand position went from extension, and it went straight down over the next third of a second, 300ths of a second. Let's go to the same corresponding point using the smart paddle, and we can see what the force was, what the power was at that point. And so the person not only is visually seeing what they've done, they're actually being given data as to what the effect of that is. And that really surprises people. When they can actually see a hard number that they can actually realize that, hold on, and so many people, I need to get stronger. I need to go and get stronger so I've got more strength for the swim. Well, actually, you've got loads of strength. You're just not applying it correctly. And it allows people to clearly and cleanly see what they're doing. And what is then nice is if you then say, okay, try doing this, and they can do something, and then you can literally pull it up and compare. Look at the difference. I mean, you were producing 90 newton meters of force, of which 45 were going down. At a similar point in the stroke, this time, after focusing on getting the elbow up, you're still producing 90 meters of force, but only 25 is going in a downward direction. And they can see the difference they made on the video, and they can actually put an actual hard number to the improvement. So it's immediate feedback. It's positive reinforcement of what they're doing.
Yeah. And I've used it twice as an athlete. I never used it as a coaching tool personally, but I know kind of what
it's
like.
How did you find it?
I found it very, very interesting. I do find it useful, but I think what you're saying there with combining it with the video, that's what takes it to the next level, I think, like combining the two. And that's something that I haven't done personally, but I guess I'm experienced enough and have done enough video analysis that I can kind of in my mind combine the two. But still, yeah, it is useful, and I'm definitely interested in trying it more in the future as well. Maybe even as a coaching tool. But
it was developed in Finland as well, wasn't it?
Yes, exactly. So that's I actually got to try it very early on when it wasn't really available to many people, when I was at a coaching course pretty close to where the guys come from. So one of the participants in the coaching course had gotten access to it as being a friend of those developers of it.
Very fortunate.
So that's pretty cool. One thing I wanted to ask is, because I seem to remember that they also have a database of like really top swimmers so that you can compare both the like the force distribution in terms of direction, but also the actual Newton numbers with others, so you can kind of see where you are and if you're actually needing more force or if it's just a direction that is off compared to what top swimmers seem to be doing.
You're right, and that is useful, but certainly with a lot of the age group athletes that we work with, it's a little bit like they're worrying about stuff like how far apart should my fingers be, you know, should they be 1 millimeter or 2 millimeter, whereas if they just work on the bigger picture stuff first, let's get you down to 1:30 per 100, and then we can start looking at do we need more power. Generally speaking, power is not the issue. Strength is not the issue. It's the application of it. And so if you, what can be maybe a little bit putting up a number that they should aspire to could be counterproductive, because they're then trying to smash out and muscle their way through the water, whereas they'd be far better focused working on getting hold of the water and just pulling themselves over it. So it's a bit like everybody's aware of what the professionals are producing, watts per kilogram on the bike. It's a nice figure to know, but it's got very little relevance to most age group triathletes.
True. I think what I'm comparing it to is things like, you know, all the cycling dynamics metrics and more obscure metrics like that. Like you have metrics now in cycling, like torque effectiveness, and in running with power meters, you have leg spring stiffness and things like that. And my issue with some of these metrics is that there isn't necessarily a gold standard. So you might not always have a clear idea of how, like, where you stack up, and if you don't know that, then that metric might have some limited use. I mean, there may be some use for some of them, but what I like about these metrics that you get from the smart pedal is that, well, you can, even if your goal isn't to try to swim like a professional swimmer, because that's just 10 steps ahead of where you are, but still, it's nice to know where you are, at what point of your journey you are, rather than looking at torque effectiveness and seeing okay, it's this number, but what the heck does that tell me? Nothing really.
Yeah, I think that's one of the problems with testing. If it's testing is done in isolation, it doesn't matter whether it's with swim or bike or run, a single standalone test really is not particularly useful. It's only useful if we then act upon it and then, you know, observe what changes are, what adaptations there are, and then plot those changes later. I would agree with you on that score.
Yeah. So with the smart pedal, final question on it, if you have an athlete that is trying to develop their swim, how often would you want to test them with it and check their development with that tool?
I would say, in terms of, I like to work with, I like to recheck and retest 6 weeks. I think that gives enough time for whatever behavior, whatever adaption we're looking for, to take effect and to be ingrained into their stroke. We identify, we'll do an analysis. We will identify what we wanted to work on. We can't work on everything at the same time. So we'll identify, we need to do this first. We implement the changes. We ensure that the athlete is fully understanding of what they're actually doing. So to do that, you need to have very clear communication so they understand the key coaching points of what they're trying to do, and then go away, implement it, repeat it consistently. 6 weeks later, come back, and then we can monitor. Has there been the change that we were looking for? Do we need to reinforce it a bit more? Or, in fact, is that now well enough ingrained that we can now move on to the next tier? Have we got the entry fixed? Yes, we have. So let's now really focus on getting a strong catch. We have a strong catch. Let's now focus on timing, or focus on holding the catch all the way through the pool.
Yeah, and I realize I have one more question about the smart pedal. What I haven't done when I've been testing it, I've always done that with just looking at very short intervals, like up to maybe 200 meters, if that. And what I think might be interested is to see swim a moderately hard 1,000 or 1,500 and see how your stroke might degrade. Is that something that you have done or used?
Yeah, I tend to have them swimming 300, 400 meters at a steady pace. And you can actually see if one of the things you can observe is on stroke by stroke, you can actually then see what is the difference between the first stroke and the last stroke, if any. And if there's not, then that really tells us that the behavior we'd be wanting to work on is ingrained, even under fatigue, which is what we're wanting. It's the ability to perform a task under fatigue that is the real goal of learning a skill.
And do you find it is very common that that the stroke does degrade even within that 300 or 400 meters from the beginning to the end?
When they come in for the we've first taught them the behavior and they're implementing it up front, yes, you'll see it drops off massively. If they're practicing it over a 6 week period, you'll generally see that it actually is fairly consistent.
Okay.
And if it isn't consistent, then what they need to do, if there is still the drop off, then it just tells me we need to go back and practice it more, integrate it more. There's no point moving on to the next step if that isn't. Swimming is incredibly hierarchical, and it's one of the things I often saw with coaches. They will give drills, and I was asked to go and observe at one club, and so the coaches were there at the poolside, and they were busy working on mid skull. And everybody was plowing up and down, up and down, up and down. And most of the people were doing the drill quite badly. When I looked at the swimming, I could see that they actually really had no clue how to even initiate the catch. So I said, okay, why are we working on mid-skull? Asked the coach, why are we working on mid-skull? Okay, why aren't we focusing on front skull to help, well, entry drills? Oh, no, we did that last week. Mm. Now, that's just, we did those drills last week. No, that's not the purpose of a drill. A drill is not a warm-up. A drill is not something you can do to fill up mileage on the deck. A drill is to teach a behavior. And if it's not done properly, I tell people if a drill is done 90% right, it's 100% wrong. The yeah. drill has to be done with thought and with precision. And if you do that, and you do that long enough and often enough, you will then get it correct, and it will then be holding, and you will have the impact of that for the 300, 400 meters. And only once you've done that can you move on to the next one. People are scared, coaches are scared of boring their athlete. And they try to keep lots of innovation and change and difference because they say, oh, my athlete's going to get bored. Well, I'm sorry. Sometimes you've got to be bored. If you want to do it properly, it takes repetition. And boredom is one of the prices you're going to have to pay.
Yeah. The way I view drills, I totally agree with that. And I sometimes in my mind compare it to when I was younger, I used to do quite a bit of music, play different instruments, and practicing scales in music is something that is, you can't play it. Like if you get something slightly wrong, then the scale is wrong. Like you have to get it perfectly right. And you keep practicing it until you get it perfectly right. You don't move on to the next more difficult one until you have the current one really, really perfected.
I think that's a brilliant example. I'm going to nick that if you don't mind.
Yeah, no problem.
that's exactly it. So I can recall speaking to one coaching course. One of the coaches actually came up to me afterwards, and he said, you know, as an athlete himself, he always used to pitch up late for sessions because he couldn't be bothered doing the drills. And that was because it was never explained to him what the purpose of the drill was.
Yeah.
I mean, if you explain to somebody why they're doing the drill as opposed to just do these drills, if they understand what the purpose of it is, if they understand how it's going to impact upon their swim, their run, then they're more likely to do it. And if they understand what they're trying to achieve with it, they're more likely to do it correctly. And if they do it correctly, they will get improvement. And if they get improvement, they will be motivated to do more again and again and again. It's a self-motivating thing. But if you don't understand why you're doing the drill, or if you're just rushing it through because you want to get onto the main set, you're never going to get the improvement. Never.
Yeah. And that's a good segue, because I think that applies to training as a whole, like to coaching. If your athlete knows why they're doing a workout, then what the purpose of the workout is, then they're more likely to execute it properly and to adjust based on what the purpose of the workout is as well. So with that segue, let's go back into discussing coaching a little bit. As you mentioned, sure, you have done a fair amount of coaching education and the coach facilitation. So for listeners in the audience that might be interested in getting into coaching, or just to people that are already coaches, what general advice would you give to coaches based on what you've seen in your coach education career?
Yeah. First of all, understand why you want to be coaching. Okay. You know, what is it you want to get out of it? If it's just something to pass the time, then you're probably not wanting to be a coach. The very best coaches across all sports historically have always come from a teaching background. You know, John Wooden, Bob Dwyer, Ian McGeehan. These are guys who are teachers, because coaching actually is pedagogy. In fact, if you look at a lot of the master's coaching courses that are now available, pedagogy is one of the subjects you have to learn. So understand that coaching is not just about the technical stuff. It's not just about the science. And in fact, I would argue that coaching is more about the how you get people to do things rather than what you get people to do. It's not just about the reps. It's about communication. We talked earlier on about feedback, how important feedback is. It's having the trust. You need to be organized. you can have the most knowledge in the world. If you're not organized, if you can't rock up on time for a session, then you shouldn't be coaching. I do believe that somebody with limited knowledge, but who's organized, clear and concise and planned, they're going to give a better session and be a better coach than the most scientifically gifted person who doesn't know how to communicate that information to the athlete. So understand why you wanted to coach. Understand that coaching is what it's about. It's an interaction with somebody, first and foremost. And if you don't have those communication skills, go away and work on those. As I said, I was at a seminar last year. One of the things that was said was that with the boom on online, all the information is out there. Anybody can go online, and with a little bit of work, they can get a training program. They can work out what they should be doing. Okay. That's not what coaching is. Coaching is, you know, helping the athlete identify their goals, identifying their weaknesses. You do need to have some technical knowledge, obviously, but it's not the be-all and end-all. And I see so often people on courses, they come on courses and they want to learn, how do I do this? How do I periodize? Tell me more about, what level of intervals we should be doing. Tell me more about smart paddles. Tell me more about stride. When in fact, most of them would be far better off just learning to how to actually demonstrate correctly and how to communicate correctly. If you want to get into coaching, understand that coaching is teaching.
What would you say are some ways for people to learn how to teach, demonstrate, communicate, all these things, that skills that you mentioned? Do you have any tips for how to work on them?
Yeah, go and watch other coaches. Watch how they engage with the athlete. And you can identify quite quickly the good coaches and the bad coaches. I went to go and observe a completely different sport. It was a mixed martial arts event, and there was coaching going on there. And it was so obvious that there was two different coaches, and they were coaching a completely different styles. One was effective, one was completely ineffective. And you could see by the engagement of their athletes who was the more effective coach. Video, if the coaches don't mind, video what they're doing. Then go out and practice it yourself. Take a session, ask somebody to video you while you're running a session, and then review back through it. When you were giving instructions, so often you'll see people out on the field and they're giving instructions while walking away from the athlete. So, and you don't even realize you're doing it. Often they'll be demonstrating, and they're demonstrating from a position that half the people can't see. So being able to, if you do a session, have it recorded if you can, and then review it. Go back over it. Look for those things. Okay. Were people engaged? Could people clearly see? Okay. And if the person who's videoing you couldn't see, if they couldn't see the demonstration correctly, then the athletes probably couldn't either. Don't be scared to ask. I've got about seven coaches that I work with. And we're all sharing ideas. We're all passing ideas back and forward. And a lot of it is not about how do we increase their VO2? A lot of it is about, okay, person's going through a rough patch, what can we do to motivate them? Having a network of coaches, a community of practice, is a brilliant idea. If you can set up, and you don't have to be experts, but if you can set up a coaching community of practice where you can round table things and it can be technical, it can be subject matter, it can just be dealing with people, that helps tremendously.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And that's something that we're also doing within Scientific Triathlon. Every couple of weeks we have a round table. And a lot of the times it's about soft skills like communication. I don't even want to call it soft skills. I don't know if that's the correct term, non-technical things. Because that's, as you say, the technical things, anybody can find them online. A lot of them people can find on this podcast, really. So it's not, they don't need us as coaches to learn those things necessarily if they are just motivated enough to educate themselves in the technical skills. But it's about these other things that really make the big difference with having a coach versus not having a coach.
And I think one of the key things to be careful of is we are currently living in this over-communicated society. There is so much data out there. And in fact, on my Twitter timeline, a day doesn't go past where there isn't something, another paper being published on this. And you think, oh, I've got to read this, I've got to read that. And so much of the information would seem to be contradictory, that you can get paralysis by analysis. Work out what you're doing. Make sure, keep it simple. If you're starting off, keep what you're doing simple. Don't try and overcomplicate it, and just stick with it. And as long as you're applying basic key points and you're keeping it consistent, you're not going to go too far wrong. People try and get way too fancy, way too quick. And for example, again, those people who are doing more and more advanced drills in the pool, why? Because, well, we need to do those drills. Keep it simple, decide what you're wanting to focus on, and cut out as much of the noise as you can, because there is so much noise out there. A lot of it is very valid. A lot of it is very good. But you cannot keep up to date with everything that's going on unless you're a full-time researcher. I'm not saying don't be aware of changes and don't be aware of technology, but you cannot spend all day, you know, trying to keep up to date with what's being said. There's just too much noise.
Yeah, and that's where, again, as you mentioned, the network really comes in, because if you have that good network, then somebody will tell you, hey, look, this interesting paper came out, and you can just ask them, so what's your take on that? And if you trust them, then of course, I mean, in some cases, you want to form your own opinion by reading the piece, but sometimes, as you said, it's not possible to read everything, as you said. So having a network where you can rely on each other's knowledge and reading different things can really help you get more knowledge than you would otherwise be able to do just on your own.
And when we're talking about networks, people forget that the best way to learn something is to teach it.
Yeah.
And so if you're getting a network, and then you're saying, okay, I want to explain to the guys in the group this concept. If you're having to teach it to them, then you're going to actually know it. By the time you're actually presenting it to them, you're going to know the subject matter. So huge, you can't go wrong with that.
Yeah. From an athlete's perspective, what are the benefits of getting a good coach?
Basically, they might have, let's go back to the age grouper who's a triathlete who's plateaued. The coach will most likely have a different approach. So he's going to force you to do things slightly differently, which is likely to have an adaption, which will be an improvement. I think what's also important is a coach should be giving you that feedback. So you're getting that feedback, both positive and negative. There's a sense of accountability. If you've taken on a coach, that coach is going to hold you responsible and accountable for your actions. And I think probably the last one as well is that you're making a commitment. You're making an investment. If you're spending $120 a month on a coach, for a lot of people, that's a sizable amount of money. And if you are doing that, then you're actually going to, when the going gets tough and when you're down and the training is hard, there's been an investment, and that's a commitment that you're more likely to stick with. It's easy to get out the door when you're paying for something.
Yeah, absolutely. And follow up on that, what do you think the state of coaching is today, and where do you think it's going, and in triathlon specifically?
It seems everybody who's done an Ironman is a coach. There's a plethora of people offering coaching services. There needs to be a professionalization of the sport. Coaches have got to become a profession. It can't just be a side hustle where you're doing it on the side just to make a few extra bucks. And for that to happen, then qualifications have got to be recognized. There's got to be a standardization of those qualifications. There's got to be an accreditation process. And, you know, if you're wanting to be a coach, you need to have met the following criteria. And that's got to be brought into law. That's got to be legislated. I think that's the way it's got to go. And we're nowhere close to that. And it doesn't always, and that's not going to necessarily alienate a lot of coaches who are out there coaching already. I think there has to be a process of recognition of prior learning. So you don't have to have a degree, but if you can show evidence that you've done the following over the last 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years, and you have got, you know, concrete proof of concept, and you have, this is what I've done, this is how I've done it, then I think that should be, there's got to be a process by which that is then considered as, you know, recognition as, yes, adequate learning, adequate expertise. So I'm not saying everybody has to go to university and study, but I do think there has to be an accreditation system. And at the moment, there's just too many people offering online courses whereby you can go online, you become a level one coach or this coach or that coach. And what you've actually done is you've learned how to use a training program. You're not coaching. You cannot be a coach if it's been done entirely online because of what we discussed, the soft skills. Coaching is as much about the soft skills, and you cannot get that from an online course. I had one of my coaches asked me to look into a course that they were interested in. So I went on, had a look at it, I went through the material. And the trouble with it was it ended up leaving you asking more questions than it answered in the first place. And this was, this actually was a course that has been accredited by a fairly significant body. And I'm thinking, you know, and because it's all online, there's just no way that you can actually get. I looked at it and I thought, you know, that's. I don't see how you can actually utilize this. So I think there has to be standardization of courses. Who does that? I wouldn't even begin to know to ask. You've got the International Coaching Education Body, which is trying to standardize, but you also have ITU doing their courses. You've got World Triathlon doing theirs. You then have private companies offering coaching courses, and they're all pulling in different directions. So I hate to say it, but I think it's a very confused picture at the moment. And I think it's not good for the athletes because the athletes, they're looking for a coach and they have it's very difficult for them to identify who actually is a good and acceptable and accredited coach. Some people, it's obvious, but you can look at who they've worked with, and you can, more importantly, if you can identify who they've improved rather than who they've worked with, then great. But I also think with the professionalization of coaching, there has to be, it will allow us to look at other issues in the sport, for example, ethics. There are people who are coaching in triathlon along with other sports that, in my view, should just not be coaching from an ethical point of view. We've seen it with gymnastics recently, the abuse that takes place. You know, I'm familiar with cases involving triathlon where people should just not be allowed to be coaching. But at the moment, we don't have that ability to remove said coaches from what they're doing.
Yeah. And on a slightly different note, what is something within coaching that you're currently interested in, maybe learning or educating yourself in, working on? It can be anything.
At the moment, I'm looking at functional movement analysis from a biokinetics point of view. I want to see how that ties in with what I'm doing on the run. I've, you know, recently started looking at using motion devices on the run, not just on the foot, but on the spine, on the legs, on the feet, and measuring the angles. And again, coming on from what TrainSense did with the swim. But to do that, you know, I need a better understanding of functional movement analysis and biokinetics. So I'm looking at that at the moment, and scares me how little I actually know. It's terrifying.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, there are all these 1,000 directions that you can go in when it comes to just furthering your knowledge of triathlon, because it's three disciplines, and
yeah,
plus all the things that, like, the nutrition and hydration, and then all the non-technical stuff that goes into it. There's just so much, it never ends, but that's a good and inspiring thing as well.
You mentioned nutrition, and wow, that's a whole quagmire.
Yeah.
When people ask me about nutrition, get very nervous. It's the joy of triathlon, though. There's so much to always learn. You're never in the position where you think, I know enough. You're always left thinking, okay, what more do I need to know? and it constantly it pushes you on. I know less now than I did 10 years ago. And that's only because I now know that there's so much more than I knew there was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
It can be overwhelming, but it can also be incredibly rewarding. When you see somebody clicking in the pool, or suddenly the run just comes right, the absolute glee on their face, that light bulb moment when they get it, that's what we coach for. That's really what we coach for.
Absolutely.
Doesn't need to be the results. Doesn't need to be the results. Doesn't need to be the positions. It's just the ability to see improvement. It's a very privileged thing to be able to do.
Yeah. Is there something that I didn't ask that you feel that I should have asked, or that you might want to chat about? Any topic
that
we missed?
I mean, I think one of the fascinating things at the moment, and I'd be interested in your views on it, is that how triathlon is diverging with the different disciplines of triathlon. By that, I mean, for example, we have, you know, obviously Ironman, non-drafting. We have Olympic distance, we have sprint distance, we have ultra, we have cross tri. We've even got the team relay, which is bringing a whole different level of tactics and specialities into the sport. I'm fascinated at where triathlon's going. It's no longer a single sport where, you know, it's swim, bike, run. I think it's really interesting about, are we going to see people specializing in team relay? Are we going to get tactics coming into team relay whereby you choose people to do certain things? You might remember back in the London Olympics, there was the British team chose was actually there for his biking. And everybody thought, yep, okay, they're going to use him. And in fact, that was a whole con. It didn't go down that way. I think it's fascinating to see how the sport splits. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but there's definitely a divergence in the sport. And I'm interested to see how it develops.
Yeah, me too. I think it's certainly a positive thing that we have players coming in, like Super League. I think it's a huge positive for the sport and the PTO as well. And it will give more options to the athletes to develop and develop according to their strengths, where they think they can have the most success, and not necessarily follow a predefined path. I think that the mixed relay in the Olympics is fantastic, because that can be a really exciting event for people that are not triathletes to watch and eventually grow the sport. So I've, generally speaking, I think that I'm quite positive about the future of the sport and how it develops. Yeah, let's see. I'm sure that down the line, more specialization will come into it. But for now, I feel that all of the events we have, even from Super League, mixed relay, to at least 7.3 racing, but even Ironman racing, you can still be maybe not the best in the world, but you can be up there if you're just good enough, like some athletes have shown, like the Norwegian athletes. Vincent Louis has raced a little bit on the 7.3 racing scene and so on. How long that's going to last, I think that at some point it won't be possible to win the Super League race series and win like a very, very challenging or competitive 71.3 race, let alone Ironman, in a few years' time, maybe.
Yeah, an example of that is in rugby. You had 15, the 15-man game, and you've got sevens. And for centuries, people have gone between the sports. But it's now actually got to the stage where if you're a sevens player, you don't really play the 15s game, and your 15s game, you can't really play the sevens. And I think that's what may end up with some of these. I think the difference between Olympic distance and 70.3, I think that's manageable.
Yeah.
But I think people who start specializing on the sprint stuff and on the team relay, you're not going to see them lining up on an Ironman.
No. Yeah, I agree. And now let's move on to the rapid fire questions. So take just one sentence to answer these. And the first one is, what's your favorite book, blog, or resource related to endurance sports?
Book would be Jack Daniels.
Yeah.
Read it years ago. Still have my tattered copy. It was just well thought out, well presented, and you can't go far wrong, with Jack Daniels.
Daniel's running formula. Running formula, not the whiskey.
Yeah, but both are good. And also, you can, I mean, what a cool name for a coach. You wouldn't want a coach called Jack Daniels. I mean, come on. Yeah.
What's your favorite piece of gear or equipment?
For me personally, right now is my Stride. It's a game changer. It got me running for the first time in 10 years, simply because it forced me to. Previously, trying to get back into running, you're always comparing yourself with what you used to be able to do, and you get frustrated. To picking up a Stride and utilizing it, I've now got a different metric which I can't hold any comparisons with, and it allowed me to park the ego, I used to be able to do this. It's a complete new start, and also just the amount of data you can get from it is great.
Yeah, and finally, what's a personal habit that's helped you achieve success?
My insecurity.
How so? Can you elaborate?
I'm always concerned that I don't know enough. I'm always concerned of, have I done this right? Could I do it better? So I'm consistently having to go back and review what I'm doing, checking what I'm doing, and consistently looking for, always looking for, okay, is there another way of doing it? I suppose it's the imposter syndrome. You're scared of being... I keep waiting for somebody to tap me on the shoulder. I started off by saying I'm the accidental coach. I keep waiting for somebody to tap me on the shoulder and say, what are you doing? You know, you didn't do sports science. You were never a sports person. How can you be a coach? So you're constantly having to, even if it's to yourself, justify that, yes, you are doing it. You are doing it correctly. You are doing it to the best of your ability. And it's that fear that I think drives us to be better coaches.
Yeah.
It drives me to be a better coach.
Yeah.
Or try to be a better coach.
That's great. Finally, where can people find you online and in Cape Town and on social media?
I don't use social media much. My wife does. But we are on Instagram under Dynamic Coaching. It's Dynamic. I'm on Twitter as well.
Dynamic with an I.
Dynamic with an I, named after my wife, Dynamic, Diana. Her name was Diana, so we spelt it with a D-I as opposed to a D-Y. So it's Dynamic with an I. And our website is dynamic-coaching.com. You can go on there. You can drop us an email from there. If anybody's got any questions, more than happy to answer any questions anybody's got. Or if you just want to rag me off about how silly I sound, then that's also fine.
Perfect. Well, I really enjoyed this conversation, Neil. It was a great pleasure. So thank you so much for taking the time. And I'll hope to talk to you again soon.
No, I enjoyed it. And thank you for the opportunity. And it was a privilege to be on the show. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Neil. Please let me know, by the way, for this episode and other episodes, whether they be interviews or solo episodes, what you think. I'm always happy to receive feedback on my email, michael@scientifictriathlon.com, and that is Michael with a K. Also, suggestions for topics and guests that you would like to see is more than welcome, so don't hesitate to be in touch. As usual, you can find the show notes for the episode on scientifictriathlon.com. We will link to the Dynamic Coaching website and Twitter and Instagram profiles. And also, I've linked to the TrainSense Smart Pedal website if you want to find out more about that tool, since we discussed that in quite some depth. Big thanks to our sponsors, Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Check out their wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses, and get 20% off your order with the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS. And thank you to Sen8. Use the Sen8 swim trainer to improve your technique, power, and stamina, even when you don't have time to go to the pool or when pools are closed, and get 20% off your order on the swim trainer with the promo code that you can get on sen8swimtrainer.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.